Welcome to the Omfer podcast.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is David Marsh. I'm the chairman of OMFIF. It's a great pleasure to introduce Catherine Mann, who's a member of the Monetary Policy Committee, an external member, so an independent member of the Monetary Policy Committee of the Bank of England. And she has been there since September, but this is her first official written speech, which will all be up on the website in the Bank of England. This is totally on the record. So welcome, Catherine. Cathy, good to see you here. She's had a wonderful career where she's tried to squeeze as much possible activity into her career, having been serving on a number of very distinguished boards of academics, having been at Brandeis and a number of other esteemed institutions in the United States, having been at the OECD as the chief economist, having just left now the Citicorp for 3 years, where she was chief economist. And so she's done a bit of everything now, and we're very pleased that you're now gladdening the shores of Britain from time to time when you come to the meetings of the MPC, although you're not currently living in Britain, you're speaking from New Hampshire. And you have got the very challenging title for your 30-minute speech of Returning Inflation to Target. So we're looking forward very much to what you have to say and your slides and so on that you have here. And then we will have questions from a panel of experts at the end. And we will also, of course, be looking forward to questions from the audience that you can send into OMFIF or via the chat function. So, Cathy, great to have you with us. Welcome to your inaugural speech, and we're looking forward very much to what you have to say.
Well, thank you very much, David, for that introduction. I'm really looking forward to actually being over in the UK. I've had tremendous experiences whenever I've visited. You know, I started my career as a central banker. I started at the Federal Reserve Board of Governors in Washington. And yes, I've transitioned through all of these other positions. But I've come back, you know, come back home to roost, so to speak, by joining the Monetary Policy Committee here at the Bank of England. But, you know, as an international economist, I've always studied domestic economic conditions through the lens of global influences. And this year, the UK offers a really excellent laboratory. Global factors have been at the forefront of the inflation surge in the UK, and their effects will persist into early 2022. However, expectations for wages and prices for this year, if realized, could keep UK inflation strong for longer, which might then generate a reinforcing cost-price dynamic. Today, I'd like to talk about returning inflation to target. To do so, the Monetary Policy Committee's first line of defense is to dampen expectations of future price increases. Achieving an inflection in these expectations, along with tailwinds from global factors, could mean a shallower path of future rate rises is needed to bring inflation back to target. Now, I'd like to start by talking about the initial conditions and the 2021 surge. So if we go to the first slide, we can kind of get a sense of what we're working with here, the challenges we face. Before we can assess the prospects for returning inflation to the 2% target, we need to recall the initial conditions and review the sources of the 2021 inflation surge. Going into the pandemic, the UK CPI price level was roughly trending along its 2% inflation path. You can see that in the left-hand panel. Now, this was unlike the US or the Euro area, which had seen persistently lower inflation than intended. In the first year of the pandemic, with lockdowns disrupting a wide range of activities, some firms did cut prices in the UK, and some markets simply did not exist, so there weren't no prices at all. And you can see that the aggregate price level flatlined. Both recovery in demand and supply limitations in 2021 have now yielded robust inflation momentum, which we can see on the right, which, if price expectations are realized, is poised to continue into 2022, moving the price level further away from the 2% trend. So if we move to the next slide, we can really get a handle on the key sources of the 2021 inflation surge. These are energy and core goods, both of which are importantly driven by sources external to the UK economy. Global goods prices, of course, have been elevated by the rotation away from consumer-facing services towards goods purchases. This has been a global phenomenon, but the dominant driver of global goods prices is the interplay of three successive U.S. fiscal stimuli combined with geographical mismatches of containers, production stoppages in key economies, and for key materials. But of course, there is a domestic UK equivalent to the global supply-demand imbalance. It's also been apparent with production constraints and, of course, the well-known shortage of HGV drivers. The waves of demand and supply uncertainties encourage multiple inventory ordering, which by accentuating the original shocks are reflected in upward momentum to prices, particularly for intermediates and final goods. What this is, of course, is the macroeconomic manifestation of the bullwhip effect familiar to operations managers. All told, the incoming CPI inflation data since November have not been consistent with a stabilizing inflation rate, which was forecast at that time. And you can see that by the gap between the line and what was forecast, the tops of all of the bars. Now, will the underpinnings to the global dynamics and their domestic equivalents moderate with inflation easing, or will the 2021 dynamics repeat in 2022 to keep inflation strong for longer? To gauge prospects for inflation, I consider a range of data and importantly, these all important expectations. So let's talk about the data and then about the expectations. So turning to the next slide, the first question is, how broad-based is inflation? Much inflation commentary over the last year has explained high current rates by pointing out a very few volatile components, such as fuel or automobiles, while arguing that underlying inflation was still benign. While this may have been true initially, going into 2022, this story no longer holds up. The chart shows a number of different measures of inflation. Headline inflation, which is the MPC's target series in dark blue. The core, which purchases, among other things, energy and food, that's in light blue. The trimmed mean, which purchases the 10% outliers on either side, that's in purple. And two volatility-based series in green and yellow. I'll be talking a little bit more about those. As we all know, headline inflation reached historical rates this winter at 5.4% in the December reading. But the other two common measures of underlying inflation, the core and the trimmed mean, also are well above the MPC's target. Now, it's often said that monetary policy should look through volatile components of inflation, such as energy and food, because these tend to quickly revert to their mean. Responding to every up and down move would whipsaw monetary policy, confuse the signals, likely cause instability in markets and the economy. Now, the core and the trimmed mean are two ways to evaluate volatility, but I go directly to the concept by constructing a measure of underlying inflation based on the historical volatility of CPI components. I could then look at average inflation within certain volatility buckets. Now, as expected, if I strip out the highest volatility quintile of components, I get something close to the trimmed mean. That's the yellow line. But what's more surprising and perhaps more worrying is the behavior of the lowest volatility fifth of components. That's the green line. By definition, these components tend to adjust relatively little over time. Now, some examples are pharmaceutical products and hairdressing. But also included in this volatility bucket are housing rents and restaurants and canteens. These last two each account for over 8% of the CPI basket. So when they move, it matters. The low volatility components do not anchor inflation to the target. In fact, they tend to run above the target for the whole period since 1997. But inflation within this bucket has been confined to rather narrow and stationary bands around some mean for most of the last 25 years. And that mean apparently shifted down by about one percentage point in the post-2011 period. Starting in the second half of 2021, however, rates in the lowest volatility bucket have left their range of the last decade and now look more in line with the period of 2011 and before. This tells me that high inflation is no longer limited to components that were quite volatile, but has seeped into those that typically are rather stable. Are these just components just experiencing a COVID-related jump to settle down soon? Or are cost and price inflation dynamics that push the volatile components being embedded throughout? If robust inflation can be found in just isolated pockets, how will it get back to target? So I'm now going to talk a little bit about the key role for expectations and if those are realized, what that could mean for inflation staying strong for longer. So turning to the next slide, we show information from the bank's decision-maker panel survey. For firms, 2021 exposed them to a significant set of cost push factors. Just about everything, shipping, raw materials, wages, insurance, CO2 emission, et cetera. The question is, will firms be able to pass through these costs into their prices in 2022? On the left, the DMP panel shows an asymmetry in the relationship between prices and sales. Firms that experienced faster sales increases due to COVID also hiked their prices at much steeper rates, that's the red set of line and dots, than did firms reduce their prices as their sales fell, that's the blue. So there's an asymmetry between ups and downs in terms of pricing. Now, this convex price profile using firm-level data is mimicked in research that uses macro data to find a convex Phillips curve relating inflation to slack in the economy. In our November monetary policy report, we recognize this downward price rigidity as an upside risk to our inflation outlook. Firms' pricing expectations from the DMP survey solidify this upside risk for 2022. The panel on the right shows that firms in the survey not only raised their prices last year at much higher rates than before COVID, it's a blue line, but also that they plan to repeat such steep increases in prices over the year to come for 2022. It should be a concern that the costs from 2021 are becoming reflected in price expectations for 2022. Turning to the next slide, I'm also following wage prospects for 2022. Bank research shows that inflation expectations tend to be correlated with wage demands, and that items that consumers buy frequently, energy, food, clothing, have particular salience for their short-term perceptions of inflation. Now, on the left, you can see that there has been a rapid increase in prices for some of these salient items. So it's not surprising that consumer expectations for inflation in the short term, shown on the right, also have jumped. Now, wage compression has been a feature of the post-GFC period, but the environment of higher price inflation, for salient items in particular, and tighter labor markets, now those two combinations may herald a regime change for wage outturns. Next, I want to show some simple illustrations about how wages and goods prices might evolve going forward if some of the 2021 increases are repeated in 2022, as has been suggested by the DMP and the agent surveys. Just to be clear, these are arithmetic exercises, not predictions. We will publish the new MPC forecast in just a couple of weeks, together with our February monetary policy decision. So turning to the next slide, let's consider wages first. The left panel in dark blue shows that wages have rebounded from their 2020 trough, leading to high year-on-year outturns for 2021. As of December, wages were slightly elevated compared to the pre-COVID trend, the dotted line, but don't really show any signs of spiraling. For the arithmetic exercise to project forward from the current data, I make three very simple assumptions. One scenario holds wages fixed until they reach their pre-COVID trend. That's the green line. Another scenario continues the historical rate of growth, the historical trend, from the latest data point. That's the light blue line, which is a 3.2% mean growth. Finally, a third scenario shows what would happen to wages and wage growth if there's another strong settlement season here in 2022. That's the red line. According to the bank's agents, some further upward pressure on wages is to be expected in the coming months as firms and workers adjust to the higher costs of doing business and costs of living. To stand in for such a scenario, I let average weekly pay rise at 3% over the second quarter and then return to the pre-COVID trend growth. So there's a jump and then a return to the trend. From the perspective of wage inflation, wage settlements, even only as strong as last year, would keep wage inflation strong for longer. That's the red line in the right panel. Now, ultimately, however, of course, it is firms' pricing that generates inflation. So let's move to the next slide, which goes through these exercises for goods prices. These charts explore what would happen to the goods price rises of 2021 were repeated in 2022, as firms apparently want to try to do so. Over the course of last year, goods prices were already rising markedly and were now about 4% above their trend level. That's the dark blue line as relative to the dotted line. Similar to the wages example above, I show three scenarios, and the only difference is that we are looking at a 4% price rise in 2022, consistent with the outturn for 2021, and consistent with what the DMP survey says that firms want to do. From the right-hand panel, it's immediately apparent that all of these pricing scenarios imply robust goods price inflation rates by year-on-year metrics. If we take the current level of prices as given, most inflation in the near term is already baked in. Even if prices stopped rising right now, goods inflation would arithmetically increase to over 6% in February. Peak goods inflation does not differ much between these scenarios either. It's going to be between 6 and 8% sometime in the first half of this year. What does differ significantly is the length of time for the price shock to work through and return inflation to trend. In the two more benign scenarios, where goods prices are unchanged or only grow at the historical average of 1.2%, core goods inflation reaches its pre-COVID average by the end of this year. But in the scenario where firms push through another 4% price increase, inflation remains strong for longer. From a mechanical perspective, any shocks to the price level only wash out after one full year has passed. This strong for longer scenario potentially makes for a very uncomfortable year, 2023. Further, this exercise assumes that the jump in prices is not repeated, and that cost inflation does not get embedded in pricing behavior. Now, there are a variety of underlying factors which might push up prices in 2022. Uncertainty is one of them. Bank research finds that in a model of incomplete information, beliefs about competitors' pricing can affect the optimal pricing behavior of the firm and therefore aggregate outcomes. And bank research also finds that using U.S. data, that a loosening of supply constraints perhaps paradoxically also supports faster price growth in the short run, as loosening supply is met with even stronger demand. But global trade is another factor. And if we turn to the next slide, we can see that disruptions in global trade are likely to persist through 2022 in some shape or form. Although shipping rates look like they might have peaked, they are still very high compared to their history, and they have raised the cost of trade around the world. Now, that cost of trade can be seen in two different ways, costs in monetary terms, but also delivery times. UK PMIs, which are on the left, reflect the ongoing disruption in the global trade environment, shipping and so forth. We know that variation in delivery times generally has small effects on aggregate prices. But the especially severe disruptions in 2021, which are likely to persist, likely will show up in prices into 2022. Delivery times being so long was going to show up because, after all, time is money. The evolving trade situation that the UK has post-Brexit may exacerbate any inflationary impulse from global goods and commodity markets by adding another wedge of administrative costs, as well as potentially changing the competitive landscape and perhaps altering the variety of products available. Bank Research estimates a widening Brexit wedge on the supply side of the economy of some 2% by the end of 2024 compared to the pre-COVID trend. Now, we can see on the right already that UK export volumes have been tracking well below their G7 peers. And it's important to note that these are flows, not stocks, so that every month below potential reflects lost business for firms and lost wages for workers. Now, there are factors that could dampen cost-price dynamic, not always upward. The ingredients appear to be in place for inflation to stay strong for longer. And if costs become embedded in prices, a reinforcing dynamic could occur, but it is certainly not inevitable. There are headwinds facing firms' pricing strategies, and ultimately it is whether firms can raise prices systematically that determines the inflation path. Now, of course, among those headwinds is the monetary policy commitment to temper any such reinforcing inflation dynamic. But before getting to that one, there are other headwinds that are potentially in evidence already. Turning to the next slide, most important potential headwind to price inflation comes from demand conditions. As shown above using the DMP and the firm level data, we know that strong sales support robust pricing and weaker sales do not. Prospects for 2022 GDP growth in the UK, coming from Consensus Economics, for example, have been systematically downgraded over the course of 2021 to the January 2022 survey. These are all the Consensus Economic monthly expectations for GDP growth for a variety of countries, and the UK is in the dark blue. With this downgrade, the UK economy is a clear outlier among the advanced economies, the blue line, and you can see the dot, which is the significantly different from the other economies. As well, prospects for global GDP growth have been dialed back for 2022 by the international institutions, and as noted, UK trade has underperformed. The second issue, of course, is that consumer purchasing power has already been eroded by the inflation to date. And going forward into 2022, energy prices, housing costs, additional taxes, these could further weigh on consumers. And COVID, of course, social distancing as well. Another headwind potentially is that global prices could decelerate more than expected, especially if U.S. demand for goods slows, if the global consumer holds on to their savings, if supply responds up robustly, and all this shipping problem normalize. However, whereas UK goods prices tend to evolve with global goods prices, the Brexit wedge could temper how much of this possible global downward momentum translates into domestic prices. It's also relevant that financial markets exhibit a very steep yield curve, which would tend to raise borrowing costs, reduce investment, moderate house prices and wealth accumulation, and thus temper economic activity. I'd like now to turn to the implications of all of this for monetary policy. The inflation surge in 2021 was initially viewed as transitory and based on narrow categories exposed to demand rotation and supply constraints and disruptions. But as the key categories of good prices and their inputs experienced multiple waves of global and domestic demand rotation and supply scarcity, what was transitory at first morphed into more product categories and into labor markets, raising even the least volatile components of the UK CPI. Going into 2022, current price and wage expectations coming from the DMP survey are inconsistent with the 2% target. And if they are realized in 2022, are likely to keep inflation strong for longer. In my view, the objective for monetary policy now should be to lean against this strong for longer scenario. But at what time horizon and using what tool? As the scenarios show, inflation rates in the very near term are mostly a matter of arithmetic, not one of policy. Further, to the extent that global inflation underpins UK domestic inflation, monetary policy's reaction would have to be more severe than appropriate for domestic conditions alone. So what monetary policy needs to do is temper the 2022 expectations for wages and price increases. Now, I know that there's been a lot of talk about the cost of living squeeze in the UK. It is not my goal to make this worse than it already is. And in fact, my objective to bring inflation back to target is so that workers can enjoy real wage gains from their labor. The small bank rate rise that I voted for in December was to act on the commitment to the 2% target so as to influence the 2022 strategic decisions that workers, businesses, and asset holders are now making. Changing expectations is the first defense against a reinforcing wage price dynamic. Monetary Policy Committee will meet in the coming weeks. Preparatory briefings will assess current and expected strength of domestic and global demand, prospects for supply disruptions and costs, expectations for prices and wages, and of course, health developments. I will make an assessment with regard to policy only after reviewing the research from the staff, as of course, will other members of the committee. The path for monetary policy must have the medium-term objective of steering the economic and financial environment in which expectations, wages, and prices evolve so as to reach the 2% target. To the extent that monetary policy actions now dampen expectations, and to the extent that any deceleration of global prices is passed through to UK inflation, and to the extent that financial markets are already cautioning decisions, the next steps for the MPC could exhibit a shallower path. Now, lastly, I'm going to leave you with a teaser. In addition to the external forces of demand and supply that have loomed large in the evolution of UK inflation in 2021, going forward, there is another important external factor relevant for UK economic performance. Policy actions by other central banks
You've suddenly gone on to mute there, Catherine. You've gone on to mute for some reason, just as you came up with the sting in the tail. I don't know if we can get you back on to...
Yes.
There we are.
Okay.
You, as you were mentioning the teaser, we went
okay.
on to...
Okay. Hmm. Interesting. Interesting. Okay, my teaser. In addition to the external forces of supply and demand that have loomed large in the evolution of UK inflation in 2021, going forward, there is another important external factor relevant for UK economic performance. Policy actions by other central banks have cross-border ramifications, which will be important for the committee to consider. But that is a topic for another speech. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Catherine. That was a model of its kind. Very robust, very well argued, splendid graphs. So thank you to Leonard Brandt and others for the graphical material. And I think a sting in the tail delivered with some theatricality by the unwarranted muting. So thank you very much. That's really a great inaugural speech. We've got a panel who want to ask a few questions, but just one or two from me to begin with, if I may. You meant very emphatically, you made the point about expectations and how you need to make an effort here. And if you succeed in that, then the rate rises will be shallower. So that was a very strong message for us. Counting up all the things you said in your speech that I was doing as you went along, you said about two times more factors that seem to be indicating stronger for longer rather than the factors indicating a mitigation. Is that an accurate reflection, would you say, Catherine, of your own feeling about the fact that there's a real danger here of inflation getting out of control? Is that arithmetical ratio that I noticed as an indication of, shall we say, your degree of hawkishness?
So the exercises that we've done here show that if expectations are realized in 2022, that we end up with strong for longer. The exercises do not then turn that into a wage price inflation dynamic, but it does suggest that a key role for monetary policy is to ensure that the wage price dynamic is not something that we see going forward. So the expectations is the first defense, and then after that, we have to judge whether or not those expectations have been moderated.
We'll go on in a moment to Maurizio Ghirga, who's the chief representative of the Banca d'Italia. We have also Beata Javorcik, who's the chief economist at the EBRD. We've got Catherine Nice, who's the chief economist at PGIM, the Prudential Financial of the United States, and we have Alistair Ryan from the Bank of America. Just before Maurizio opens up his salvo, Catherine, just one point on UK fiscal policy. Right. You didn't say too much about that, and indeed there is a compact that you let the government on the whole get on with its job and they let you get on with your job. But what do you think of the present monetary fiscal mix in the UK? Do you think the Chancellor is doing the right thing at the moment in terms of the very great dilemma he has regarding economic growth and inflation?
Well, it's my job to react to the combination of fiscal and monetary policy and not to opine on the fiscal decisions. I mean, we do work as a pair when we talk about, you know, the implications for the economy, but we do stick to our lanes.
You keep your tanks off his lawn, I think. That'd be another way of putting it.
Okay.
Maurizio from the Banca d'Italia, your question, please.
Yes. First of all, thank you very much, Catherine. Very interesting. And, you mentioned the problems that may come from wages. So at the moment, do you see that wage rises are still limited to a few specific sectors? And given that there are these scenarios like the one you mentioned for a stronger inflation, in that case, how do you weigh the risk of a widespread wage rises?
So we do have quite a bit of work. In fact, you can see it in the monetary policy reports that look at the sectoral distribution of wage increases. And there's quite a bit of variation. That's the first point to make. The second point is that there is some relationship between the sectoral wage outturns and sectoral, say, vacancy to unemployment ratio. But it's not a strong, relationship. So we can't say that we can always, you know, if there's a huge, very tight labor market in a particular sector, that that's the one that we see the highest wage increases. That's not something that is as clear in the sectoral level data. The third point that is that as we are still in the we are still in an environment where there is quite a bit of compositional change in the workers who are coming back into the labor force and coming back into employment and therefore being part of the wage observations. There's still a lot of that going on post continuing COVID, but as we evolve towards a new situation with regard to employment and COVID. So the composition of the labor force and the not just the sectoral composition, but the wage composition is also a very important part of the average wage growth that we're observing. What I do think that we do see is that the low end of the wage distribution receiving, they first are the ones that are changing jobs the most. And that secondly, when you change your job, you're more likely to get a wage increase. And so the job churn that we think, that we see in the data, is contributing to this observation of higher wages. Now, of course, in some sense, you want people to change their jobs to get a higher wage and better match. So this is all good from the standpoint of improving overall labor force dynamics. You know, what we don't want to see is just the whole thing getting out of hand.
Thank you. Beate, could I ask you to put your question, please?
Thank you very much for your speech, Kathy. If I may take you beyond the UK, have we reached the point in which international trade has become a source of permanent upward pressures on inflation rather than downward pressures as it has been in the past? In other words, are supply chain problems chronic? Are they likely to worsen in the future? You know, in the short term, you can think about zero COVID policy in China leading to disruptions, negotiations with labor unions in LA, Long Beach ports, also are likely to cause disruptions. And then looking beyond extreme weather events, as well as carbon border adjustment mechanism, can also have an impact here.
That's a good question. And it certainly goes to a lot of the work that I've done over the years. We look at an environment, I think it's important to think about goods prices and international trade prices through a couple of different lenses. One is the historical one with, you know, the period of time following China's entry into the WTO and into the global trading system. That certainly was a period of time when there were downward pressures to the global goods prices. Now, you're pointing to a range of both policies as well as other factors. You know, reactions for wages, weather events, you know, carbon border, these are all, would tend to offset or uplift prices, global goods prices. On the other hand, we have to think about how much competition there is in, global markets, especially in global goods markets. There are a lot of producers. They want market share. We continue to have supply chains being reoriented in order to get lower prices. Yes, there's an appreciation for the carbon issues, carbon footprint. Yes, there's an appreciation for resilience, taking into account the tail risks that are in the distribution of possible outcomes. So it's not just, you know, the cheapest average labor costs I can find someplace. But it's also the case that firms will be competing with each other to get those markets, to get those global markets for goods. And that competitive pressure, I think, is a driver that is ultimately going to be the one that keeps global goods prices in check. Now, we are looking at, you know, we're looking at a particular point in time right now where demand surge has not been met with, you know, elastic supply. Supply takes a little bit longer to get online than it is to buy something on an online platform. So we had goods demand surging. Supply was less elastic. So you have a goods price surge and that equilibrium. But supply does become elastic one way or another. You change your locations. You have multiple plants, et cetera. And then that competitive pressure from firms around the world is going to reassert itself. That's what I see ultimately as putting the cap on global goods price inflation.
Well, thank you very much.
Technology as well, right?
One could almost build a speech just out of that topic by itself, I think, Beata and Cathy. So thank you for that answer. Can I go over now to Alistair Ryan from Bank of America?
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, Catherine. So talk about the bank's commitment to its 2% target. So right now, observed inflation is obviously wholly inconsistent with the target. Market pricing in the forwards market is expecting the bank to miss its target on a five-year horizon. The economy is bigger than it was beginning of COVID. The labour market is clearly a lot more challenged. Your balance sheet's twice the size it was, and your rates are still 50 basis points below. I'd have expected a sense of urgency in the rate hiking, given that mix, and I didn't get that today. So could I invite you to comment? Thank you.
Well, your starting point, which one of the factors that you were saying is that the economy is bigger. It's not, actually. The economy has not returned to its pre-COVID trend. We could argue exactly whether it's COVID, whether it's Brexit, but the economy has not returned to its pre-COVID trend. With regard to labor, we have not returned to the pre-COVID labor force participation rate. So we do think that there are still workers on the sidelines. Getting them back in, obviously, is an important part of the puzzle. You saw the consensus economics series that I chose to show because it's a monthly observations on expectations of a slowing in the expected rate of growth of GDP for 2022. Those factors are important for thinking about where we should be going with rates in the near term. It's also, I thought I pointed out that the extent to which inflation is either coming from global factors, the global goods prices, we talked about that a lot, or coming from some institutional elements as well as global factors in energy, that these are two very important components driving the inflation surge that we see. If we were to try to offset those right now, we would be talking about a very, very big hit to economic activity, to labor and to businesses. And that trade-off, we have a primary objective, which is inflation, but in our mandate, we also talk about the extent to which our actions should not add to volatility in GDP. And so we have to consider the sources of the inflation surge. My objective in showing the exercises on expectations was to show the extent to which the prices that we see right now in goods are baked in We can't do anything about them. What we do want to be able to do, what we do want to do is temper expectations so as to alter the time period over which this strong inflation is observed. We temper expectations and temper the outturn. If we temper expectations, temper the outturns, then we limit the strong for longer and then avoid having embedding a price wage inflation dynamic. So I do have a sense of urgency, but I have a sense of urgency for the things that I think I can affect. And the current surge in goods prices is not one of them.
Well, thank you. Just before we go on to Catherine, I detected not a lack of urgency, but almost like a coiled spring that you would become more urgent if you
right.
felt your message wasn't being acted on. Is that a reasonable interpretation, that the sense of urgency yes. would certainly be there if the yep. messages you're giving do not have the right result?
That's very well put, David.
So can we go to Catherine now, please?
Thank you so much, and thank you, Catherine, for your speech. I really would like to emphasize, I think these kinds of speeches are incredibly important, and having worked at the Bank of England in the past and through a period where inflation did deviate by much more for much longer than was anticipated in real time, you know, one of the real lessons that I learned from the people around me at the time was it's very critical that central banks have a narrative for how we got to where we are today, where they see inflation going over the medium term, and how they're setting policy to get inflation back to target. And when I look at other central banks, I'm deeply concerned that this clear communication, really, which comes down to an assessment of what has led to, what can account for the inflation surprise over 2021. And it's this lack of narrative, in my view, that creates an impression amongst market observers that central banks don't understand why we are where we are, and therefore gives a sense that they've lost control. And therefore the sense of there's this great urgency to get back to where we are. So I think that the kind of analysis that you've shown here today is just critically important. And I would encourage you to continue to communicate that, let the Bank of England be the odd one out in a good way. My question comes to a chart that you showed, and it sort of links to my comment here, where you had these measures of UK inflation year on year. I don't know if we can show the chart again. You had all these different versions, you know, of trimmed mean and the like. And right. and it really is this point that you did actually see these measures all creep up in the years following the global financial crisis. And yet policy was able to stay exceptionally low throughout that period. Many people at the time were calling for tighter policy, including some external MPC members. In the end, policy did not go up and inflation did come back to target. Obviously, global financial crisis, totally different from a pandemic. But at the nub of the issue, they were both negative supply side shocks. So my question to you is, what is it in its essence that you think is potentially differentiating the situation that the UK finds itself in now that could warrant tighter policy that was not true back in 2012, let's say? Thank you so much.
Okay, let me see if I can, if Leonard is there, he can pull up the...
Yes, I have asked Leonard whether he can do it. Okay. So he okay. will put that up while you're speaking, Cathy.
Okay. All right, here we go. So your question is, what is different now than then? I guess I'm interpreting that. So you can see here, I think first, the there's an important observation looking at these volatility measures, which again, I like these because, you know, if what we're supposed to do is look through volatility, let's kind of look at volatility. So here we've got them, the yellow and the green. And this stepping down of the mean volatility and the lowest volatility quintile in the post-GFC period, not quite post-GFC, it's a little bit after, but it's basically post-GFC period. Now, as I say, this is above the 2% target, so you can't say that, you know, this bucket is going to anchor inflation. But it is an important bucket. As I say, the two largest components, restaurants, canteens, and cafes, it's a category, each one of them accounts for 8%. So one of the things that I think is important to think about what happened in the post-GFC period is a long period of wage compression. By what I mean is that prices were low. Firms did not believe that they could increase their prices. You know, demand was really not very strong over most of that time period, right up until, you know, until pre-COVID. And when firms didn't think they could raise their prices, the way they maintained profits and earnings was through wage compression, an important ingredient of both through wage compression. Well, where we are now, I think, is potentially a regime change where we have a tight labor market, we have tight goods markets, we have the combination of those two generating high inflation. And that is an environment where firms and workers both see themselves as having pricing power. And that's where the DMP survey comes. We're expecting to be able to raise our prices by 5%. This is where some of the expectations from the agent surveys of how strong they think that some of the negotiations, the April negotiations, might be. You know, we are where we are with regard to last year and then this year coming forward. And so the objective is to ensure that we don't get a reinforcing inflation dynamic. And I think we are in an environment where we have a lot of goods price inflation and wage inflation coming from both tight markets. Going forward, there is going to be moderation in the goods prices. I think that there's some judgment calls about how much of a moderation potentially there's going to come from that. But we, as I say, our first line of defense against a wage price inflation dynamic that we are uncomfortable with is to moderate the expectations that are currently being in evidence, and we get these expectations, we get these surveys monthly, and of course we can see the outturns on an even higher frequency basis with some of these higher frequency data sets that we currently look at, cards and online and mobility and so forth.
Well, thank you for that answer. I'm sure we'll be able to deepen all these. Yeah. Questions at a later stage when you actually come over here and when we're allowed to have these meetings again. But I also thought that the graphs showing this interesting way that the non-volatile price elements have been seeping into the overall body were very, very interesting indeed. We've got quite a few questions coming in from the audience now, Cathy. So if you don't mind, maybe we could slightly overshoot. If you have got 5 minutes more at the end, that would be very, very helpful if we did have a margin, simply because there are so many questions coming in. But if I could just put one question, which is about the balance sheet. And the questioner says, is it possible to give an indication of how the gradual rolling off of the balance sheet will impact and be somehow juxtaposed with your interest rate increases?
So the box in the August monetary policy report is the indication of how we think a strategy might be going forward. And there is bank research, some of it online, that is evaluating how a change in the balance sheet, the two different stages of changes in the balance sheet, might be reflected in not only the gilt markets, but also in other markets, because of course there is some substitutability between gilts and corporates, corporate bonds. So, so I think it's fair to say that we're on the case here. We are looking very carefully at how these two tools, the bank rate and the balance sheet, work in the overall market conditions. And then, of course, ultimately, market conditions, financial market conditions, what we care about is their implications for the real economy, inflation, and economic performance on the real economy. So we have to look at not only how the two tools work with each other, how they work with the financial markets, and then ultimately their implication for the real economy. So there's multiple links in the chain, the two tools on the markets, and then the markets on the real economy.
Presumably, you've got to do quite a bit of coordination with the Debt Management Office about the new issuance as well. So that is another element to the equation. You might just be figuring that out, maybe,
in
your new role.
We don't do coordination. They tell us.
Well, okay.
We take that as an input.
Right. And then another question from the audience is about the degree of the wealth effect that might have emanated from the quantitative easing that we've had over the last 4 or 5 or longer period of years. And the question says, in the Federal Reserve case, this wealth effect does seem to be taken into account in a big way in terms of pushing up consumer demand from the more wealthy section of the population. Is that an impact? Is that an element that you take substantially into account in the UK as well?
Well, I mean, we certainly have a sense of the value of portfolios, value of housing. Those are two important sources of wealth. And what the distribution across the population is of those components of wealth. And we definitely look at the, shall we say, marginal propensity to consume out of wealth, of the different types of portfolios of wealth. So if the question is, are you taking account of the income distributional consequences of your policy actions, past and future? The answer is yes.
Yeah. Another question about the rate of interest, which is very much following on from Alistair Ryan's question, really. The questioner says that what do you consider these days to be the neutral rate? I mean, it clearly isn't the rate that you have at the moment. Right. And do you not think that the neutral rate, whatever you think it might be, maybe between 1% and 2%, you could tell us what you think it should be or what it is. Do you not think that over time you will need to increase interest rates to the, quote, neutral rate, end quotes, in order to dampen down what you obviously fear, which is some kind of wage price spiral?
Right. Well, you know, I said in the speech that there are factors about the steepness of the potential bank rate path, and that if a variety of these factors, that dampening expectations, goods prices abroad, variety of demand factors, that these would yield a shallower path than might otherwise be the case. So I am talking about an upward path. That's definitely in the cards, but you know, the pace and the ultimate end point are still ones that depend on what we do today, and as I say, or next week, 2 weeks from now, what we did do in December and what we're what we may end up doing, who knows, in February. You know, the neutral rate, R star, quite a bit of focus on that. Financial markets love R Star. My view is R Star is an important ingredient in R Star's productivity. Ultimately, that is one of the key underpinnings. A lot of questions about productivity, especially coming out of COVID. And that is an important ingredient. But I also want to caution that there have been other stars that central banks have been prone to use in the past. U-star, meaning Nehru, pi-star, meaning our target, and different measures of that. And so R-star has, as much of, it changes over time. It's not a fixed point. And as I say, I think one of the key factors about the neutral rate going forward is what do we think is going to be the outturn on productivity growth?
Yes, maybe it's not too far-fetched to talk about the mutation of R star and more or less aggressive variants of R star. Quite a number of questions about interest rates, so I'll just paraphrase them because we are running out of time and you've kindly consented just a couple of minutes of extra. Could it be thought of in nautical terms that the rise in interest rates that you decided 8-1 majority was a shot across the bows? And so you're preparing for maybe a possible next round. The trouble is, it's all very foggy out there and we can't actually see the ships that we are sailing against. And therefore the admiral has to really be very, very careful about too many shots at this stage. The questioner says, is this an appropriate nautical way of describing the dilemma that you are in?
Well, there's a lot, inflection points are a very challenging thing to see in advance, right? And we are in an inflection point with a lot of the data that we're observing. And it means that incoming data is very important. Sometimes people say, well, you're changing your mind based on incoming data. And it's like, well, yes, sometimes at an inflection point, incoming data really does make a difference in assessing where we are. So whether you call it foggy, whether you call it uncertain about the relationship between a policy rate, financial market interpretation, and then implications for the real economy, there's a lot of different time dimensions that we have to be keeping in mind. That's part of the fog. We can have effect on financial markets quickly, but on the real economy much, much more slowly. So there's that's part of the fog. The data are part of the fog. And so we do have to tread carefully. One of the reasons why I focus on expectations so much is that because, expectations first, action second. So, that's my, focus at this point.
All right, thank you. And just two more questions from the audience and then we'll stop. I'm sorry for those who have asked questions, not able to put them. But one is that when you actually get to the Bank of England and when you start work there, obviously on a part-time basis, are you going to be making some changes to the way that you receive incoming data? Should we say, are you going to be asking for changes in procedures in terms of getting even better statistical material and so on? Or do you have no preconceived notions about that whatsoever at the moment?
Well, I'd have to say that, in my short time at the bank, I have found that the staff have been extremely responsive to the types of questions that I ask. My background is very much a firm level data, disaggregated data are the way in which we can evaluate macroeconomic outcomes. Now, my job is macroeconomic outcomes. But the only way that I think I can do that job well is by looking at a lot of disaggregated stuff. The questions that I've asked with regard to the data and with regard to the questions, expectations, for example, persistence of inflation, these sorts of questions, these are the staff has been incredibly responsive. Either that or they are. We're already doing it, and it just happens that I arrived at the right time.
That's a good answer. Thank you. And the final question, really interesting sting in the tail, the teaser you put in the end. You mentioned other central banks. I think we know that the Fed has gone on to a more hawkish emphasis in the last few weeks. That's quite clear. The European Central Bank is obviously very important for the UK. It is our biggest trading partner up to now. They've had a fairly dovish view. They've said we're not in the same position as the United States. We don't need to raise interest rates this year. To what extent do you think there could be that the ramifications, as you put right at the very end of your speech, to what extent would that have an effect on you if the ECB did, against its present policy, decide to move for one reason or another to a slightly more hawkish tonality? What ramifications would that have for the UK?
That's the next speech.
Good. Well, this is very much like the next James Bond film. You know, who's going to play James Bond? So we'll keep that intriguingly open. And there will be a next speech. And I hope there'll also be all kinds of interactions with you of a more informal nature as you get your feet under the table in Threadneedle Street. So I'd like to thank you very much on behalf of everybody who's been listening. It's been a really good, very rigorous, very granular, but very interesting, thought-provoking speech with the hint, I thought, of a mailed fist inside a gloved hand. That was the view I had, but that may be a bit of a cliche, but I can see there is urgency there, but not quite yet.
Well, you know, there's urgency, but I also have to, you know, you could, how much can we get done with language alone?
Good. Okay. Well, we'll leave it there. Thank you very much indeed for your time and enjoy the rest of the day in New Hampshire. And thank you everybody for listening and look forward to meeting you again before too long. Thank you for our panel of
thank
experts.
Thank you very much.
Your
thank
very
you.
Good thank questions. You. All the best and goodbye for now.
Thank you for listening to the OMFIF podcast.